Linda Gregerson's honors include a Guggenheim Fellowship, 4 Pushcart Prizes, a Kingsley Tufts Award, and the selection of Magnetic North as a National Book Award finalist. She is a professor at the University of Michigan, and her poetry has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Poetry, The Yale Review, and all those publications that nobody can get into but really good poets. Linda, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations on your new book, Prodigal, New and Selected Poems from 1976 to 2014.
God help me. Who thought I'd be alive this long?
Oh, it's a fantastic book. I've been dipping into the poems and enjoying them quite a bit. You have poems from your first 5 books and then some new poems, and you start the organization of it. And I don't know if this is something that you wanted to do yourself, or if it's something the editor suggested?
Oh, it was. No, I blessedly was able to devise the sequencing in the book.
Oh, now that must have been quite, could be fun, and it could also be a little difficult.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And in some ways terrifying, though it wound up being less ghastly or less labyrinthine than I feared it might. But the sequencing, there are all sorts of models, I suppose.
Right.
One can do the very difficult thing of actually trying to make a trajectory that doesn't observe chronology at all. And I knew that was way beyond me.
Oh, that would be tough, because then you would have to do it like based on some sort of aesthetic quality or thematic.
Right. Oh, I know. It would have been too many. It was mind-boggling. But then there are a few templates available. People either do chronological sequencing or reverse chronology. I thought of both of those. But the one I used, where the new poems appear first and then the sequence moves chronologically through selections from my other books in the order in which they were published, seemed to me overwhelmingly the best one.
I imagine that there's sequencing, but there's also, you know, selecting, that you published poems from each book, starting with the first one, which I believe came out in 1982, Fire in the Conservatory.
Yeah.
You started with that one, but you didn't and couldn't include every single poem from that book. Was it difficult to select poems and leave some out?
Well, you know, that's interesting. What I feared in the case of the first book was that it was going to be difficult to figure out anything to include. I've thought of that book as being, you know, before I learned how to write properly. Now, mind you, I slaved those poems, so it wasn't that they were simply, you know, tossed off, but I worried actually that they registered too much of that working. What I hadn't figured out was a pacing for the poems, and there's a stanza form I devised for the second book that I then used for a very long time, and that felt to me as though I'd really, that I felt like a real breakthrough. So I was actually afraid about publishing anything that had appeared before then, before I learned how to do that.
It reminds me of what Borges said in an interview that I read. He can't read any of his books, that once they're out, he can't go back to them. The implication being that it was too painful to see what a naive writer he was. And I can imagine that could be tough. But on the other hand, Borges-like, did you find yourself communicating with an earlier version of yourself and maybe learning something about yourself from the past that you hadn't thought about?
Well, I did, I think. I was surprised and relieved to learn that I could think more highly of that first book than I'd imagined I could. That a lot of what I care about and care for poems to do, to be mindful, to really address the world around them with curiosity, to think through things in the course of evolving rather than simply reporting on stuff understood off the page.
Right.
I mean, to my mind, that's a paraphrase. That's not a poem. That's what you're doing.
Right.
And I found them all, you know, they were honorable in that way. They were worthy. And indeed, a lot of the preoccupations of them are ones that have continued through for me to this very day, that it really was a formal matter I hadn't yet figured
out.
Yeah. So that again, I could feel honorable about including some representation of that book.
Do you think the search for form for an artist, whether they're fiction writers or poets or musicians, that search for understanding and perhaps moving towards mastery of form is a lifelong thing?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't mean to say that I've somehow landed and now there's no more to be done
but
simply ride, you know, this wave. No, not at all. I mixed metaphors horribly there, but...
I'm with you. I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
No, of course it is. It's evolving. But, you know, sometimes there was this sense of being terribly cramped or confined or writing things that for me were airless in ways that just felt not right. And once I discovered that sort of staggered stanza and could invite more white space, frankly, into the poem as it moved down the page, I just felt, I mean, I really felt kind of rescued. And so, of course, one keeps trying other things and pushing at the boundaries of this. It's very dangerous to get to know a form too well.
Right.
Also,
yeah.
Because you can kind of get on automatic.
And you can become a parody of yourself, which
Absolutely.
You clearly have not done.
So it certainly is lifelong. But still, there are times when one feels more thwarted than other times.
I don't know if this question is even a good question or a relevant question, but it just occurred to me that when we watch movies from the 80s, it's almost hard to submit yourself to the dream because of the haircuts and because of how silly things look. And
yeah.
And I'm wondering if there was difficulty in terms of, did you encounter any earlier poems that more reflected a time that didn't translate to today?
Oh, that's such a great question, the haircuts question. I'm actually going to use that in workshop when I teach. So great.
Awesome.
You know, well, I suppose in some ways it might have been thematic or temperamental. There are those, a lot of writers are obsessed in early years
right.
with that phase of life, right? Thwarted love, relationship, you know, ghastliness and all those sorts of things. And I suppose, you know, one looks back on that and thinks, thank God I don't have to be young anymore and live through that.
Oh, my God, I know what you mean.
But in other forms, the haircut phenomenon, which I mean, it's a great tagline for it. I don't know that I found other versions of that or other manifestations, really.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine most of the differences or the things that would be difficult or a challenge to negotiate would be more, as you kind of alluded to, in my case, it would be if I were to look at things that I wrote when I was a young man in grad school, it would be probably angry in your face. I'm going to share some truth with you to
exactly.
the point of being a little irritating.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, please.
Yeah. I'm talking to Linda Gregersen. Her new and selected poems, Prodigal, is hot off the presses. I noticed in your first book, your line breaks, well, your line, not your breaks. We'll talk about breaks later, but your lines are aligned on the left-hand margin.
Right.
But then your poetry moved towards different alignments. Sometimes the first line is indented and the second one isn't. And, you know, you have this variation of aligning. What is that for you? I mean, that's really one of your characteristics, really, as a poet, as I look over in this retrospective. Why and what does it do for the line? What does it do for the poem?
Right. Well, that flush left, I mean, for one thing, I wrote the whole first book that way because I didn't really know there were other options.
Oh, excellent answer.
And it did seem as though everyone was writing that way. I mean,
absolutely.
I must confess, I just, you know, it was that much of that was written in the 70s and in the very, very early 80s, and
right.
it was a dominant look. But what I like to do in poems, both kind of in terms of where the mind is tracking and where images go, but then also a third thing, the way syntax plays out. I like to do a lot of sudden pivots, that as I like a poem to accommodate something that's almost non sequitur, that is pursuing a problem or a question partly by going elsewhere. And when I had those, what I think of as those four square stanzas, the one four square, right? They're, whether they were four lines or not, they were flush left and they looked like rectangles. That those kinds of turns, that conceptual or rhetorical pivots, came too thickly. They imposed on the reader. Whereas when I had this visually looser stanza, there seemed to be a little more time for absorption built in. And I guess there was also another rhythmic thing. Is, I mean, the stanza I developed and used just about exclusively for two whole books, and that was a lot of years because those books took me a while to write, was a tercet. It was a three-line stanza. And so the first line was flush left, and then there was a deeply indented, what I think of as the pivot line, a real short line, often only one metrical foot, and then a shallowly indented third line. And that first line tended to be longer, the middle one real short, the third line not quite as long as the first. And if you look at them metrically, which I don't expect readers to do necessarily unless they've got particular interest, they wind up being a kind of like 5-1-4 or 5-2-4 pattern in terms of a metrical feet. And it just... there was something about that. It's almost a dance rhythm, isn't it? I mean, it had a little more musical life for me, and I loved the way it interacted with the units of the sentence and phrase. It just seemed truer. It seemed it seemed more honest, truly, about the way I thought my way into those poems and that I wanted to be available to the reader.
What I was thinking as I was reading the poem was, I imagine the poet, you know, sitting at her desk or wherever, you know, she writes, and the poem having incubated for a while, allowing the syntax to be released, to unfold, and that the syntax unfolding itself is intimately connected to how the poem appears on the page and how the lines are made and the indentions are made.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Everything I understand about making a poem has to do with this lover's quarrel between line and syntax.
Oh, love that.
That they partly agree to get along, and sometimes they're duking it out, and resistance is the chief mode. And I think that's how I move down the page. And it also, it's interesting because that lover's quarrel, that contest for dominance, really, between line and syntactical unit, also gives me the information I need about at what pacing the feeling and thought in the poem needs to emerge. So sometimes it's clear it needs to switch gears. It just needs to. It needs a refreshment. It needs an exclamation. It needs a change of tone. It needs a little lightening up. And it needs a counterexample, something like that. And I get a huge amount of that information from the emergence of line and syntax.
So I imagine that for you, the revision process is pretty thorough, to say the least.
Yeah, and I'm afraid it's also pretty, it may be kind of idiosyncratic at this point, which is to say, and I don't particularly recommend my method. I feel kind of stuck with it in a way. I don't think I can change at this point. I revise obsessively, but I do it parcel by parcel as the poem emerges, so that I might have, you know, the first three or four lines might be unstable for a while, but I work them and rework them and rework them and rework them before I then go on to the next several lines. I don't find I'm able to do a loose draft and then go back and revise, partly because I wouldn't have the information, right, from that sort of crafted syntax and lineation. I wouldn't know where to go as the poem is emerging, but also what I find is that if I try to revise that way, after there's a whole draft, the poem gets homogenized in the wrong way. No matter what I try to do, I need the surprises to authentically occur as the poem is emerging. That is, I think a poem, the flip side of saying what I said before about a poem shouldn't be a paraphrase of something you figured out before you got to the page, is that I really think poems need to be places where you discover something you didn't know before you hit the page. And for me, those surprises, they have to be prepared for, which means that sometimes they have to be deferred. I have to build and craft and revise again and again and again a certain kind of build in the poem before I get to a turning point. And that what's missing when I do whole draft revisions based on something looser is the impact of discovery. It's just gone. I just can't make it happen.
And you're saying, and I think people should listen to this if they're writing poetry, you're saying that you don't write a loose draft. I assume what you're meaning is that you don't sit down and write an entire draft because that draft directs and homogenizes the meaning itself of the poem.
Well, or rather, it's more that the revision I do then that would kind of lick the thing into shape, that the poem already knows where it's going.
Because for me,
that's deadly.
Yeah, so revisions are restricted to what the poem is seemingly trying to say.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. So then how do you walk into a poem, and what do you walk into a poem with? Do you walk into it with an image? Do you walk in with language, with syntax? And how do you know how far you can go before you need to stop for the day?
You're asking such brilliant questions. And let me first reiterate about that, you know, my method, if it deserves that name, is that I do not recommend it as a universal process.
Right, absolutely.
I think it would be awful and wrong, probably for almost everybody.
Right.
It happens to be something I need.
Absolutely.
And as to what I begin with, you know, it can vary enormously, right? It can be a piece of syntax, a bit of language. It can be an image. It can be, you know, the view outside my
right.
window onto the snowy woods in back, and the deer that's had a damaged leg and is trying to make her way across the snow. It can be sometimes something in the pressure of events and circumstances in the world around me, a horrifying image I've seen in the newspaper that day.
Or perhaps like Sweet, the poem about that alludes to 9/11.
Yeah, yeah. And that, you know, I certainly couldn't have set out to write a 9/11 poem.
Right.
What I could start with is my kind of anger at the condescension of this Brit, you know, toward what he took to be my mother's naive reaction
right.
about 9/11, which I took to be the only moral reaction in the world, what she said, that, you know, it wasn't about blaming anyone in particular. It was about the world erupting necessarily when there are radical differentials of well-being in it. You know, for my mother, God bless her memory, that was an intolerable world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is, and I think it should be for all of us when some of us do so well and so many others suffer so intensely.
So anything really can allow you to walk into a poem,
mm-hmm.
but how do you know when it's time to stop going in for the day?
Oh, God, when I can't stand it anymore, you know.
Or when you have to get to class.
Well, that's it. That's it. Or when I have to make supper, yeah. Or when I have to, exactly. You know, I'm not, alas, systematic in my writing schedule. When I'm writing, any bit of seized time can be immensely helpful. 10 minutes between things can be help. Or, you know, there can be 4 hours of unproductive tinkering with line breaks. Oh, that's not unproductive, tinkering with line breaks.
Absolutely.
At the end of it, I may well, at the end of 4 hours of hard work, I may well come back to the exact line breaks I began with, but at least I know there aren't other options at that point.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's so when I know it, I just think, I'm not, this is, I'm getting drab. I'm not doing, I'm pushing. It's not, this isn't what I want to be writing. I'd better come back fresh.
You made an allusion earlier that as you're looking out the window, a deer with a wounded leg crossing the landscape. I'm probably not saying it as beautifully as you did, but it reminded me of Szymborska's poem where the deer jumps into the poem.
Yeah.
And it makes me think that it doesn't matter whether it's an image or it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, it doesn't matter how you get into it because they're inseparable. If you can separate the deer from the language, then the poem probably isn't going to be that good.
I think that's very well put. I do. And I, you know, God bless the disruptions in our lives, right? And that there's something that rescues me from mere inwardness and obsession. God bless. And I guess that's another way of saying that what I was trying to describe before in wanting to write poems where there are pivots or swerves or kinds of porosities where other things come in, whether it's other voices or an angled piece of narrative. I believe that poems can be great sort of knitting factories, right? They are opportunities for us to discover connections between things that might seem at first utterly divergent.
Yeah.
And you've just described another way in which that can happen, the supposed interruptives, which turn out to be the things that put us back on track.
Yeah. Since we're talking about the revision process, I had Donald Hall on the show when his collection of essays came out about aging.
Yeah.
One of the things that he says in the introduction to that book, he says that his very first reader used to be his now deceased wife, Jane Kenyon.
Right.
And he says, but I always gave her the best draft that I could. You know, my instincts as a writer is sometimes when I have a first reader, I give them the first draft and it's crap. oftentimes. And I'm wondering, when you are ready to hand over a poem to your first reader, at what point in the process are you, and who is your first reader?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, my first reader actually is my husband, Steve Mullaney. He's not a poet. He is, which I think is a godsend
yes.
to both of us. and he is a brilliant writer himself. He's a scholar of the English Renaissance. And so his feedback is actually very, very contained. He doesn't try to rewrite or make other kinds of suggestions, but he might say, this is a little hard to follow, or there's a little something glitchy right there. Very, very discreet responses, and often that'll coincide with something I was fretting about and be just what I needed to confirm.
Right.
But I don't show things to him until that draft is as finished as I can make it.
That
I don't
seems
show it
really
to
important. That seems really important because I think if you show it prematurely, then you know the poem becomes about meaning and about clarity, and perhaps it hasn't found the meaning or the clarity.
Right. I mean, I certainly think meaning and clarity are crucial things, but one, again, I seem to be terribly interested in protecting the poem's ability to discover that necessary process by which the poem locates meaning it may have been it or we, I, the writer, may have been heading toward one way or another, but which still have blank places or muddy places or things yet unknown. or unclarified.
I like to think of starting a... I'm a fiction writer primarily, but I like to think of starting a new work as, you know, walking into a forest. And, of course, you don't know where and what you're going to observe and what the meaning is going to be when you go out to the other side, but it certainly is a beautiful walk. One of the things is I kind of have a last question because we're running out of time. I really love the book, Prodigal, New and Selected Poems, 1976 to 2014. This is a representation of your life's work in poetry, yet there's no introduction. Why?
Oh, that's very interesting. Gosh, well, it never occurred to me to write an introduction. My editor didn't ask me for an introduction. I'm relieved to report. And well, I wonder if I'm the best person to say things that would go in an introduction.
You didn't think about getting another poet, perhaps?
No. No, I wouldn't want anybody to have to take on that burden. I guess, I mean, in a naive fashion, I'd love the poems to be able to speak for themselves. And I did hope that the sequencing would be useful that way. That is, I couldn't start with the very earliest poems because of what we were discussing before. I don't think I found the proper form yet.
Right.
And similarly, I couldn't end with those because it would lead you to a trail of to a trailing off. So I wanted something. I wanted poems there that were the newest I had produced, but I also wanted it to then build chronologically to see how the books are thematically connected. And I think they are. I mean, I think there are a lot of recurrent themes and obsessions, emotions, forms of deliberation and lament and celebration. And I guess I would like to think that the poems can
speak for themselves. Absolutely.
They talk to each other, actually.
Yeah, I kind of admired that about the lack of introduction. It was very, for me, it was very glaring because, you know, I read a lot of selected books, and also I teach in an MFA program, and I know a lot of young writers, and this is really weird, and I don't know if this is something of our times, but a lot of young writers, if they come out with the first book, even if it's just a very small local press, they'll ask a famous poet to write an introduction. You know, and it just doesn't make sense to me.
Oh, it's painful enough to have to ask people to write blurbs.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Linda Gregerson. And the book is called Prodigal, New and Selected Poems, 1976 to 2014. I'm wondering if we could end the interview with you reading a poem.
I would be delighted. You want me to choose one or you want to choose one?
I'll leave that up to you. But if you do want me to choose one, I do have a couple that I admire quite a bit.
If it's all right with you,
yes,
why don't I read a poem
better.
That's from a little bit in the middle of this current book. It's actually from my second book. It's called Salt.
Oh, Linda Gregerson reading from her poem, Salt.
Salt. Because she had been told, time and again, not to swing on the neighbor's high hammock, and because she had time and again gone back, lured by the older boys and their dangerous propulsions. Because a child in shock, we didn't know this yet, can seem sullen or intransigent. And because my father hated his life, my sister, with her collarbone broken, was spanked and sent to bed for the night to shiver through the August heat and cry her way through sleep. And where, while she cried, was the life he loved? Gone before she was born, of course. Gone with the river ice stored in sawdust. Gone with the horses, gone with the dogs. Gone with Arvid Aniker up in the barn. 1918, my father was six. His father thought, why leave a boy to the women? Ole, like holy without the H, a good Norwegian name. Ole had papers to sign, you see. Having served as county JP for years, you would have chosen him too. He was salt of the earth. And Arvid's people needed to cut the body down. So Ole took the boy along, my father, that is, and what he hadn't allowed for was how badly Arvid had botched it. Even his last job, the man had no luck. His neck not having broken, you see, he'd thrashed for a while. And the northeast wall of the barn, the near wall, was everywhere harrows and scythes. It wasn't. I hope you can understand the blood or the blackening face, as fearful as those were to a boy, that 40 years later had drowned our days in whiskey and disgust. It was just that the world had no savor left once life with the old man was gone. It's common as dirt, the story of expulsion. Once, in the father's fair lost field, even the cycles of darkness cohered. Arvid swinging in the granular light. Ole as solid as heartwood and tall. How could a girl on her salt-soaked pillow compete? The banished one in the story measures all that might heal him by all that's been lost. My sister in the hammock, by Arvid in the barn. I remember that hammock, a gray and dirty canvas thing. I never could make much of it. But Karen would swing toward the fragrant branches, fleshed with laughter, giddy with the earth's sweet pull. Some children are like that. I have one myself. No wonder we never leave them alone, we who have no talent for pleasure, nor use for the body but after the fact.
I have advice for our listeners. Rewind this to the beginning of the poem. Get the book, Prodigal, open it to page 80, and follow the reading of that poem. It was a beautiful experience, watching the lines and hearing them read at the same time. Linda, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you very much.